Halladay is one strike away. The 0-2. A bouncer. Ruiz. In time! Roy Halladay has thrown a no-hitter!
The 1-2 pitch. Hit toward third. Castro has it. Spins. Fires. A perfect game! Roy Halladay has thrown the second perfect game in Philadelphia Phillies history. He faces 27 batters. He retires all 27. It's the 20th perfect game in baseball history and the second one this year.
Good evening, listeners. It's a pleasure to have you aboard for this episode of the Jays Journal podcast. You're probably wondering why I'm starting with this unfamiliar format, and truth be told, I felt I needed to say a few words about the recent news concerning Roy Halladay before diving into a pre-recorded latest episode, if you will, of the baseball show. This news has affected me deeply in so many ways, and after spending most of the day going on different radio stations and podcasts and talking about my feelings related to this, I still find myself searching for words and struggling to understand exactly what this legacy is that Halladay has left behind. Roy was an absolutely special player, and during his time with the Toronto Blue Jays, or what I like to refer to as the dark ages of recent millennial fans who started to experience this team, the Toronto Blue Jays were for all intents and purposes irrelevant without Roy Halladay. In much the way that we equate Jose Bautista with the recent regime of the Anthopoulos Shapiro era, there's no question that during the Ash Ricciardi years, Roy Halladay was the only marketable reason for you to go and enjoy the Toronto Blue Jays. And I know that's obviously a very sweeping statement. There were other great players during that time, like Vernon Wells and Shannon Stewart and Carlos Delgado. But when it comes to Roy Halladay, what he was able to achieve during that stretch of 2003 up until 2009 with the Blue Jays was nothing short of absolutely immaculate pitching and quality baseball. This was a competitor in the fiercest sense, a man who, after struggling to get his game going in the big leagues, ultimately turned himself into what was universally regarded as the best starting pitcher in professional Major League Baseball. And we can't forget that, because all the plaudits will come in and all the accolades will be respected for what he did as a player and what he's done as a father and a husband and a human being. But there was certainly something extraordinary about him. I almost feel like he was transported out of time and ended up playing in the 2000s, even though he was probably more destined for being part of that Koufax Gibson mold in the 60s and 70s when pitchers just took the ball and ran with it. And as a fan, you sat back and you watched in absolute wonderment as this artist painted a glorious picture for you on the baseball field. His impact will be felt for a very, very long time. And if you're just someone who's getting into baseball recently or has enjoyed this game for what seems like ages, given how old I am, you'll come to appreciate that we will not see the likes of him again. That player, unfortunately, is a breed that's disappearing very quickly and going extinct in terms of our baseball memories. And so that's what makes this tragedy hurt even more. The fact that we won't be able to ask him questions and have him regale us with all the anecdotes and stories that comes with being the best pitcher in the game at any given time. For myself, I'm filled with deep regret. I reached out to Roy on a number of occasions to have him guest on the Jays Journal podcast, and I'm fairly convinced that would have happened sooner rather than later, maybe around Christmas. The fact that I won't be able to do that is profoundly and enormously disappointing to me, because of all the players that I enjoyed watching over the years, he was certainly at the top of my list as someone that I would love to have a fireside chat with and get him to talk to my audience and talk about his experience in a way that makes us all appreciate how a truly unique baseball player and human being he was. I'm going to refer to my last tweet that I sent out at the end of last night when I got the news, which was, he was a storybook Blue Jay personified, the best of sportsmanship, class, and discipline wrapped into one, an absolute force in baseball with an indomitable will, and the main reason a whole generation tuned in to watch during a largely forgotten era. Roy Halladay will be missed. This episode of Jay's Journal is dedicated to him, and over the next few weeks I'll be having additional guests for us to talk about memories of Roy Halladay in a way that'll make you appreciate everything this monumental man was able to do for the game of baseball. Here we go. The first post-World Series baseball roundtable here on the Jays Journal podcast. Let's quickly introduce this excellent roundtable I've put together. My first guest is a weekly contributor with Sportsnet, one of the most popular social media personalities on all things Blue Jays. Dow, Steve is here. How are you this afternoon, good sir?
I'm fabulous. Awesome.
The next guest I've got for you covers the Florida State League for Prospects1500.com and is a proud member of the Internet Baseball Writers Association of America. Jason Waddell is here. Jason, good to have you back on the show again.
Thanks a lot, Ari.
And my final guest is new to the show, and he's a research associate at the Levy Institute and a market analyst who calls himself a tragic follower of all Toronto sports teams. Marshall Auerbach joins the Jays Journal podcast for the very first time. How are you, sir?
Ari, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm glad that we were finally able to connect and do this. I respect all three of you enormously, and so I thought it would be great to have an opportunity to ask each of you, now that this is officially the first show post-World Series, it's done, the Houston Astros have prevailed over the Los Angeles Dodgers. Look, this was a very unique World Series in so many ways, and the hyperbole on the street with mainstream media is that it perhaps is one of the greatest World Series that we've ever witnessed. I want to start with you, Dow, and let's go around the table. Was this one of the greatest World Series you've ever witnessed, and what are you going to take away from this that maybe the average person didn't notice from what we saw being on display with baseball?
I would certainly put this with amongst the very best World Series that I've ever seen. Obvious recency bias and sleep deprivation caused by games running late over the past week, factored into that. But yeah, absolutely, this is one of the best, most competitive World Series. I think really having a situation which is almost feels a little bit more like a basketball final, which is where you've got kind of the two best teams in each conference making it through, and it's sort of a true test of the best teams in baseball. I think baseball, because it tends to be more of a crapshoot, you do end up sometimes with a team that you had expected to be there versus a team that maybe had no business being there, mm-hmm. and seeing how that rolls out. But two really strong, compelling, likable teams for sure. So I thought this was great fun and very intriguing and very telling.
I thought this was a very compelling World Series, and I did like that the two best teams made it. But let me preface kind of my opinion on it by saying that I tend to be a bit of a Clint Eastwood, get off my lawn kind of guy. And so, was it the best World Series ever? Not in my opinion. I will always go back to the 91 World Series with the Braves and the Twins.
Oh, yeah.
Jack Morris, John Smoltz, Game 7. And I think that we're not going to see performances like that anymore because managers aren't going to allow their pitchers to get in and into that much trouble and work themselves out of jams. I really miss the days of the starting pitchers, going 7-8 innings and having that lockdown bullpen. And I, as much as I love this series and seeing guys like Correa and Springer on the big stage and Altuve and Bellinger and Corey Seager and just the massive amount of young talent that both of these organizations have brought up to the big leagues, mm-hmm. and established, it really kind of bums me out to see a 12-13 game where the bullpens just can't get anybody out. And, I felt, for that one game, I felt like I was watching slow-pitch softball. so I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more from the aspect of seeing these young guys become what –
We thought they could do,
and seeing the realization on both sides of just this untapped potential. But I'm a bit concerned when guys like Verlander say the ball's different, and I had to abandon pitches. That concerns me. That concerns me a bit, and I can't rank a series like that, ahead of something like a Game 7 where you had the veteran Morris versus the young guy Smoltz, and they both throw zeros. So that's just me. But get off my lawn while you're at it, Ari.
Yeah, and it was that series, correct me if I'm wrong, that compelled Gillick and Beeston to basically go after the Jack Morris Holy Grail.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't get any better than 10 shutout innings.
And while
I would go along with that.
I just don't think starting pitchers are geared to go 10 innings. And it's not that I want to necessarily see that, but the amount of base runners that Jack Morris was allowed to strand in that game, it's not like he was nailing down 1, 2, 3 innings.
Yeah.
But if Jack Morris was a pitcher in today's game, he'd have been out after 2, out after 3. We wouldn't have those iconic performances on the mound. And I kind of feel in some ways a little bit cheated out of that as a baseball fan in 2017, that we're probably never going to see an instance like that again.
Funnily enough, I thought of the 1991 series as well as one of the best ones. This one was an interesting sort of mirror image of last year's, because everyone talked about last year's being a great World Series. It was only great because, you know, you had two long-suffering franchises and the Cubs finally broke through. But actually, there was only one really great game, and that was Game 7 last year. The other ones were pretty one-sided. This was kind of the opposite. You had great games 1 through 6. Game 7 was a bit of a damp squib, and it was disappointing in that regard. But I'll throw out another one that I think is even better than 91, which I'm showing my age a little bit here, but I think that the 72 series between Oakland and Cincinnati, which were also the two best teams that year, seven games, every game except Game 6 was a one-run game, and you also had fantastic NLCS and ALCS playoffs in that year. So it might very well be the best postseason of all time, 1972.
That's about 7 years before my time, but, you know, anything with the Big Red Machine and that Oakland dynasty has got to be good, right?
Yeah, I mean, all the colorful A's of Charlie Finley and of course, Sparky Anderson's Big Red Machine. Yeah, no, it was a great series, and they were all pitching, as you say, they didn't use, you had relief pitchers going, closers going 3 innings in those days as well, which is, again, never going to happen again.
I should tell you all that, candidly speaking, I've received my last 6 months of demographic analytics from Blog Talk Radio, and my average audience, 51% of my audience is between the age of 55 to 64. I bet you didn't think that was the case, but it's a testament to the love that fans have of this game, that we have all sorts of appeal in terms of our audience. So you want to reference 72, 83, I'm very close to referencing George Bell myself at some point in the show. People have to deal with knowing their history. And I felt that this World Series had so many extraordinary moments that it was almost like watching a pro wrestling version of baseball in some ways. We had it all. We had the controversy. We had a proposal at the end of the World Series with Carlos Correa. We had George Springer going off with beast mode numbers. I mean, 5 home runs, I think, after he struck out 4 times in the opening game. A player I might add, I think Dow is smiling because I think it was, what, Dow, the 2011 amateur draft, I think, that they wanted him, and they ended up getting BB instead. But, you know, long story short, there were a lot of interesting stories, but the one that I still can't understand is how Brandon Morrow, the injury-prone Brandon Morrow, made 14 appearances during these playoffs. And I'm referencing an article by Clayton Richey on Jay's Journal called World Series Takeaway. Marshall, help me understand, did Dave Roberts go insane in his handling of Brandon Morrow, or what was going on? Because nobody's...
Look, I don't think he had much of a choice. Certainly when you got a starting pitcher like Yu Darvish, who I think finished with an ERA of 21. But he, it's surprising, he actually... tied the all-time record, I think, with Darryl Knowles in 73. Again, I'm showing my age a little bit here, but he was the last guy to pitch all 7 games of a World Series, and Brandon Morrow tied that, which is quite remarkable given, as Darryl probably knows, as a long-time follower of the Jays, the guy was pretty fragile at his time in Toronto. Mm-hmm. So I think you got to give Roberts a lot of credit because of the way he used him all year. He's always had superb stuff, and you know. So I was very happy for Brandon that he was able to pitch so well. But you know, it clearly he didn't have the makeup to be a starting pitcher because he broke down so often. So full marks for Roberts, but I don't think he had a choice. I mean, you know, the bullpen was pretty well gassed on both sides. guys, and particularly more so Houston, I think, than even was the case in Los Angeles.
I think that starting pitchers that failed, whether it be injury or just the inability to get outs, that have the type of stuff that Brandon Morrow has, are suited for these types of games in the playoffs. Morrow is a really good addition to any bullpen throughout the regular season, but in the playoffs, the fragility that he showed as a starter does not translate in short burst. With him, it was always the course of, can we get to 150 innings? But the guy has the overall stamina to be a starting pitcher, and when you add in his ace-type stuff in short burst, I mean, I can't blame Roberts for really going to him because he didn't have a choice, but if you got to go to anybody, I want to go to a guy that was built and bred to start and not the guy who's been a relief pitcher his entire career in the minor leaguers, because those guys do not have the stamina, and I don't really think that they have the makeup to take the ball every day like that without incurring serious injury to their arm. And I think that's the biggest difference between Morrow, especially with the days off. You know, he really only had to go 2 games day off, 3 games day off, 2 more games. So, kudos to Robert for using the guy. I mean, he didn't really have a choice, though.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. I mean, we're talking about Brandon Morrow and sort of in some ways praising his performance. He still walked away with an 8.44 ERA out of that World Series. And so 5 earned runs in 5 1/3 innings. So it didn't necessarily go according to plan. And some of this, I think, it's interesting. I really enjoyed the different strategic approach to the World Series. I like the fact that managers will pull a pitcher after 2 times through the order. That doesn't bother me at all. I like seeing starting pitchers get up in the bullpen towards the end of a 7-game series. But one of the real key takeaways for me from this World Series is that those 3 middle games where you don't have the days off, those are the ones that you have to be aware that suddenly your managing has to go a little bit back towards what you would do in the regular season as opposed to the playoffs, because you do have, by the time that Dave Roberts hit game 5 of the series, he was reaching a point where he was really burning out his bullpen. And, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head whether or not if game 5 was the one where he pulled, he pulled his pitcher early in just about every game. But that one was the one where, I guess it was Kershaw that came out early in game 5. But in any case, I just the way that he had been managing over those couple of days led to, I think, part of what happened in game 5 and then inevitably what I think sort of brought him down at the end.
Game 5 was the game that Kershaw came out early. He didn't use Maeda for an extended appearance. And that was the game that Morrow came in and gave up the 4 runs without recording an out. So outside of that game, the other 6 games, he was nails. But
and that's when he was gassed, I think, as well.
Yeah. To your point, that was the 3rd game in a row in Houston. And so managing the bullpen that way, the entire bullpen just looked like they were done. But to your point, that's about managing in those 3 games that are all back-to-back-to-back. You can see how it backfired on Roberts because – you know, he had burned them out in games 3 and 4.
Yeah, it was, and it was kind of, I don't think that we've really seen managers manage this aggressively, whether if it be in the playoffs or in the regular season, really at any time in at least in my memory. And it is interesting to kind of see what some of the problems that arise. So, for instance, last night or the night before, you ended up with a situation where going to the bullpen early means that you're burning a pinch hitter early and in the National League park. So, you know, there are things that I think we're starting to see put into practice during game action, and being able to kind of see practically speaking how they play out, and maybe being able to put the value of, okay, maybe you don't want to necessarily leave the pitcher in for a third time through the lineup, but can you get him maybe 2.5 times through if it means that you don't have to burn a bat early on in a game and in a situation where you might not have a long bench?
Don't you think Terry Francona did manage a little bit like this last year? I thought he sort of established a template in the way he used Andrew Miller.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that has helped to set the stage for this year, for sure. And mm-hmm. and I'm sure that next year we'll see even more of that. And, you know, as well as I think the way that the wildcard games are managed. And, again, I think that's a hoot. I think, you know, that's fun to me to see Clayton Kershaw or Madison Bumgarner or, you know, whoever, Max Scherzer, you know, getting up in relief appearances. And even if it doesn't work, it's still fun to see.
But I like it in elimination games, but I'm not a big fan of it in general with the guys coming in. I mean, what Bumgarner did a couple years ago was pretty amazing. But in his own starts, he was able to last a lot longer as well. So it just seems to me like the starting pitching is really letting a lot of these managers down, and they're forcing them to go to the bullpen so early. And it's kind of
even Kershaw,
because the starting pitchers get paid so much, and it's like if I'm rooting for a team and we're giving a guy $200 million, I know it's a big stage, but I kind of want to see you at least get through 7 innings, you know. But the Dodgers, they didn't have that with Darvish or Kershaw after game one. So
yeah, Darvish has probably cost himself a fair bit of money in the free agency, I would think, after the way he performed in the World Series.
I think the Blue Jays should still give him a big, huge contract, though.
That's, you know, I'll
tell
you,
Jason. I think the Blue Jays should overpay a little bit.
That's a great segue, because we've got an article on the Jays Journal website written by one of the site experts, Chris Henderson, which he called "Keep an Eye on Falling Darvish Stock." I mean, it was a disastrous World Series. I think Jeff Passan wrote on Twitter that the Houston Astros, he was their choice for MVP of the World Series, because let's face it, his inability to find redemption after that first start is effectively what cost them their World Series championship. You know, you could almost argue that if somebody like a David Price, Justin Verlander has found himself as that mercenary who was able to contribute significantly down the stretch and win a championship. David Price tried to do the same thing. It didn't quite work out. But in the case of Yu Darvish, he's going to be available. And so, Jason, are you saying that the Jays definitely have to go out of their way and try to get this guy, knowing that he's, what, 31 years old and has a career 3.5 ERA, second in Cy Young voting, I think, back in 2013?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've said to you, you know, from day one, that the Jays' success is going to be in 2018 built around the starting rotation. And I like Darvish at the top behind Stroman in that rotation. And starting pitching is going to cost you. Darvish, has his stock dropped today? Yeah, it feels like it has today, but when it comes down to a team trying to assemble a roster for 2018, are there better options out there on the free agent market than Darvish over the course of 162 games? Other than the Tommy John, he's been pretty durable, and he keeps the ball down, he misses bats. These are the things that I want out of a guy in the Rogers Center.
I guess you have to exclude Shohei Ohtani from that.
Well, what are we going to get out of him? Kind of an unknown, you know, and how much is he going to cost? Is there going to be – I mean, he's an intriguing prospect because he's going to come over at a time where he's not going to be a legit free agent, and he's going to have to sign under the bonus pools and take the – and so when he's on the major league roster, it's going to be at the league minimum. At least that first year. And so what sort of backroom deals are teams going to have to work out with him And are they going to get in trouble for that, much like the Braves are about to get stung? So it makes the crackdown on Atlanta and their international signing under the bonus pool structure, it makes that a lot more intriguing with Ohtani, because is there going to be a lot of scrutiny with his deal because he's potentially leaving $150 million on the table by coming over now?
But that makes him a more interesting prospect for the Jays, who usually have not paid top dollar for free agents. Of course, that also is the case for 23, 24 other teams. But the problem with most free agency acquisitions is that, you know, you buy them, you know, there's this expression, you know, past performance is no guarantee of future performance. And the problem you get with any free agent, not just pitchers, but I guess in general, is you're getting these guys past their prime or at the downslope of their careers in a lot of cases, and you're paying on the basis of what they did beforehand. So here you're getting a guy who is just getting into his prime, and you're not even going to have to pay top dollar for it. It is really a unique situation.
Well, I feel like every team that can, and a lot of teams are excluded from even being able to bid on him. The Jays are not one of them. I feel like every team that can is going to be all in on Ohtani. And I'd like to think that, and maybe I'm reading into this more than is ever there, but I'd like to think that having a guy like Darvish on the team would be appealing to a guy like Ohtani as a countryman, you know, coming over and having someone like that already on the team. I don't think Dodgers can go after him. The Yankees and the Red Sox can't. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Munenori Kawasaki is already putting a plug for the Jays on his behalf. So that's
that name just never disappears from the Toronto lexicon. I don't know. Now, how do you feel about all this? Would you, knowing that there's also a poetic irony, right? I mean, Darvish was someone that Anthopoulos and the organization tried to outbid, and we now know that they fell woefully short. Remember, there was a time now where it seemed like they were going to make a legit bid, and then we found out it was nowhere near it. Why would we believe they'd go after him now?
I think that's probably why it is the Blue Jays fans are talking about Darvish, is just that sort of sense of, well, what could have been, and seeing the fact that he did have a couple of good seasons. But, you know, this past year, he boasted his highest ERA of his North American career. He's going to be turning 31 next year. He's probably not going to come looking for, you know, a pillow contract or something to get him over. I mean, he'll be looking for 5 or maybe 6 years or what have you. And I think in terms of what are the Blue Jays going to be spending their 2019 and 2020 and 2021 dollars on, I'm not sure that Darvish is the bet that I would make, especially since at some point there's going to have to be money for Marcus Stroman. There's going to be a reason to need to carve off money for Aaron Sanchez. I think there's a real core of a good rotation here in Toronto already, and I think that the Blue Jays may be well served taking a look elsewhere as opposed to Darvish in order to fill the rotation spot. But I still do think that they need someone in the rotation, but if there's someone along the lines of a Charlie Morton who, you know, was available and could come in as a 5 and pitch like a 2, that would be a great scenario. But maybe that's what we've always sort of been seeking, are the guys who have upside.
I feel like I feel like the Jays need to target a starting pitcher that can pitch like a 2 and is a 2 just in case Sanchez can't get on the mound.
Yeah, I think that's why I would look at someone like Alex Cobb. But, you know, one of the things that was clear this year was that the team, you know, you do need depth 6-7 and starters 6-7 and 8. I'm not convinced that Biagini is the guy for the fifth starter position. I think he'd be good as a long relief man. But I'm now wondering whether they want to take another crack at Francisco Liriano. He didn't play that much for Houston. He probably wasn't used properly. He seems to do very well when Russell Martin is catching him, and I suspect he could be acquired pretty cheaply in the offseason.
I like your suggestion on Alex Cobb. And I would try and bring Liriano back, too, on a $1 million, maybe two.
You mean World Series champion Francisco Liriano? Are we talking about the same player? Just want to be clear. Oh, my. Amazing where a baseball journey can take a player who starts as an afterthought and gets released by his team or rather, traded away. I mean, they got rid of him. It was decided he wouldn't cut it continuing his major league career. Now he's sitting at home thinking he's the luckiest baseball player on the planet.
It pays to be left-handed.
Now, I'm curious about this now that the World Series is over, and it's depressing. No more baseball at this level. But one thing I am noticing, I'm going to ask you this first, Marshall, is a lot of fantastic, dusty old marketing material being fed to our television screens, which normally I wouldn't complain. Who doesn't like watching Joe Carter's walk-off home run? Who doesn't like watching the heroics of Roberto Alomar and Ed Sprague, which were key to building credibility that you could win in the playoffs? Knowing that there is this new audience that has embraced this team, is it doing the organization a disservice by reliving these glory years over and over again, knowing that aside from the last 2 years before this, we went through basically a generational stretch of some of the worst baseball you could ever hope for?
Yeah, and that's the real risk, as you say. I mean, it's great to celebrate your history, but when you've got to go back all the way back to 92, 93, it reminds people that, you know, as you say, there was this 20-year period. And I think a lot of the current fan base, just judging from the comments I see on Sportsnet and the like, is still very, very skeptical that Mark Shapiro's team is prepared to put full resource into creating a sustained excellent ball club. I'm not sure I share that. I mean, I don't think that they will necessarily, you know, ever spend like the Yankees or the Dodgers, but and frankly, even if they were Cleveland North, as I always say to people, look, have you seen what Cleveland's been doing recently? But look, I do think that you have to spend the money wisely. They've been saddled with some pretty tough contracts with Tulowitzki and Martin, but I have faith that they will actually they strike me as being in a position where they are going to create some sort of sustainable structure going forward, and I think they deserve the benefit of the doubt. And but I'm not really all into this 1992-93 nostalgia. That, you know, I mean, I still look fondly at the bat flip of 2015, but I'm frustrated that they didn't get any further. I want them to get back to the World Series.
Yeah, they're kind of the marketing department seems to be in a bit of a catch-22. You can't market around the minor leagues because that's completely unfair to guys like Vlad Jr. and Bo, who everyone's excited about. You can't put those on it and say these guys are coming. That's way too much pressure on those guys. If Joey Bats is indeed gone, you can't include him other than like the highlights and the glory days and stuff like that. You know, but you got to go to a time, you know, when fans felt pretty good. But how many Blue Jays fans are around? You know, I mean, there's a whole generation. What I mean by that is there's a whole generation of Blue Jays fans that weren't around in 92. So how do you market it to that younger crowd, the 20-year-olds, the 18 to 20-year-olds, the teenagers, the young kids?
But let me be a devil's advocate here, and I want to know how you feel about this, Dow. When was the last time Keith Law came out and said to our organization that they have the number one player in baseball, and then after seeing Bo Bichette being given the accolades he picked up last week, is it really a risk to be marketing these young players to millennials in anticipation of what's to come? Isn't that an effective strategy, knowing that it might work better rather than going rehashing the past to people who weren't even alive when it happened?
Well, I mean, I guess there's a couple of questions in there. One is, what is it that we should be hanging our hopes on? And the other is, how should they be selling tickets? And, you know, I think that fans, I've heard fans complain about the marketing of the Blue Jays for every different reason from, you know, they overhyped the team, which of course they did. It's marketing. You're trying to sell products. So, but people say, oh, they overhyped this team, or they're selling the past, or they're selling future hope or whatever. So anyways, everyone hates marketing except for the marketing that apparently works on them. In terms of what the next great Blue Jays team is going to be, though. I mean, seeing the two teams that we just saw in the field, I think that Blue Jays fans really do have to hope that you have transcendent all-star type players in Bo Bichette and Vladdy Jr. At the core of what that next team is about. So, I mean, I think that those guys are going to have to actually get to Toronto before the team can realistically start to sell them. But ultimately, I think that is the direction that we do have to start looking in. And to, you know, it was a couple of great seasons, or you know, a couple of great opportunities to get back to the playoffs, to kind of change the channel on the perpetual loser tag that I think that a lot of people had placed on the franchise. Now it's time to look forward and to look at a really different team that's going to be the next great Blue Jays team.
But from the perspective of marketing, I would say in many respects the victory of the Houston Astros actually helps the Jays more than, say, had the Dodgers won, because the Astros have done it, you know, the right way, the way that Shapiro always talks about doing it, you know, but you scout, you draft and develop, maybe near the end you get a free agent or a late season trade deadline pickup. The Dodgers really have been much more of let's use our balance sheet, buy as many expensive players as possible. I mean, like, there's no way that Toronto would ever give a contract out to an Aaron Sanchez or Marcus Stroman that was given to Clayton Kershaw. Nothing close to that. And it's worth noting that the Astros actually had a payroll that was, I think, $10 million lower than the Jays this year. So, you know, there's a lot of things that you could use there and say, look, if it's done right, like Houston, shows you can win a World Series. You don't have to be the highest spending club to win a World Series, which would have been the case had the Dodgers won.
That's a good point. I don't know if you actually individually market the guys that are coming, but I think once they're definitely there, that's when you would start. And I would definitely relay to fans that, hey, you want a George Springer on your team, you want an Altuve, you want a Bellinger, you want a Seager. We potentially have some of those guys coming. But just like the Houston Astros, Keuchel, Altuve, Springer, they were all on the team in 2014 when they were horrible, and SI crowned them 2017 champions back then. I think the biggest difference is they were actually major league players on a terrible team versus, hey, look at these minor leaguers that we have that are simply just minor leaguers, no matter the accolades that they're receiving.
That said, I would say that the two that people talk about the most, Vladdy Jr. And Bo Bichette, given their unique circumstances, their parents, their dads both played in major leagues, they've been around the game a long time, I suspect they probably could handle the pressure and the marketing better than most, simply because they've grown up around this environment. But again, I would second the view of you guys that you don't want to spend too much time putting pressure on them unduly. But certainly, they're unique prospects in that regard. They have it in their genes already.
I would love for them to be marketed at whatever level they're playing at. I can't tell you how many times I went to Dunedin and the stadium had 50, maybe 50 people in it.
Wow.
And maybe that's just a byproduct of... probably that's just a byproduct of the Florida State League. Florida State League does not typically draw because there's so much other stuff to do on the coast of Florida. But, I mean, if these guys end up in New Hampshire, they definitely need to be marketed so that people come see them. I can't tell you how many times I would sit in the stands and hear people say, is that guy related to Craig Biggio? Is this player related to that Bichette guy from the Rockies? And, you know, just don't know. With that being said, at least on the social media sites, it seems like Blue Jays fans are well aware of these two guys and know everything about them and what's coming and can't wait. And a lot of debate on when those guys would be there and whatnot. So the fans, I think the real Blue Jays fans, they know they're coming. They're patiently waiting.
50 fans, that's the entire summertime population of Dunedin, isn't it?
Yeah. And most of those guys were retired of the 50 that were in there. So, yeah.
You know,
always good. If they start back in the Florida State League, you can just get down here. You'll be able to see them up close and personal with nobody bothering you, you know. No big crowds.
It is interesting, though, Jason, isn't it? I mean, we know that with the changing, with the passing of time and changing generations, how a fan embraces this game can dictate their outlook for decades, if not their entire life. And as someone, you know, who grew up in the 80s and had a chance to witness some pretty, pretty frustrating moments in Blue Jays history, I mean, devastating moments. I'm sorry, but, you know, being a 13-year-old and watching Gar Gorch weakly ground out to third base to blow what was a 3.5-game lead with 1 week of baseball left to play, you know, those are things that if they had transpired today would probably lead to some serious, serious, like, public emergencies from suffering fans. It's such a powerful form of escapism today, is what I'm saying. And one of the things that I regret when I have these roundtables, and I've done many of them, is this conversation that starts where we just accept the notion that the team won't spend or shouldn't spend, which is, don't you think, Marshall, that's absolutely bizarre considering that they had the best attendance and are the fourth largest market? Why shouldn't they spend? Why shouldn't they, in the same way that they say they wish to rebuild and contend, that they develop and invest?
Yeah, I don't really understand that. I mean, I mean, the argument is that it's not a real baseball town. That seems to be implicit in the argument. They always say, well, if it's a lease, of course, you can put any kind of crap that you want on the ice, mm-hmm. and they're still going to show out. Whereas if they don't have, I'm not sure that in the case of Toronto that they need to be good all the time for people to come out. My sense, and again, I'll be interested to hear what Jason and Dal say about this as well, but my sense is that what really killed the franchise was the cynical indifference for 20 years. It wasn't they didn't even pretend to try, and there didn't seem to be any kind of effort to developing. It was just like this was an unwanted asset that had been acquired by a Belgian brewing group that knew nothing about baseball. And again, I think Ted Rogers, when he finally acquired it, didn't actually fully appreciate what kind of a jewel he had until they started, you know, the team started winning, and then they started realizing what a cash cow it could potentially be. But I think that's what it really was. I think indifference, and the fact that you just were mired in mediocrity perpetually was the real problem, and that's what I think ultimately killed fans' enthusiasm. I think if you can still build up, even if 2018 didn't turn out to be a great year, they may not draw 3 million fans, but if you actually could show that you're moving in an intelligent direction with a good, sensible plan, then I think you could really still keep people enthusiastic. So in that regard, I think what Shapiro and Atkins and the others do in this offseason is very, very important, because I think this is the first year where they'll really define the vision they have for the club going forward in the next 3 to 5 years.
It seems to me that every team that is sold increases in value, even the Marlins. And so when it comes down to should a team spend, shouldn't they spend, I don't think that market matters. And with Toronto being the fourth largest market and consistently selling out the Rogers Center, they certainly have the means to keep their players.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what I would like to see more with teams than trading them at arbitration. Oakland and Tampa, prime examples. It's almost as if they want to hold their cities hostage to get a new stadium by trading off any one of value and just continually stockpiling a farm system. Stu Sternberger, the owner, is still a billionaire. If he were to take the Mike Ilitch approach of, I'm just going to spend when I need it, money be damned, attendance be damned, I don't care about the balance sheet, he could do that. A lot of these owners, though, they don't view it that way, and so it's imperative then, if you are going to spend money, to spend it wisely. And that means keeping a guy like Stroman if you want to invest in a deal now before he hits free agency. You know, keeping the young players when they come up and then having the financial flexibility to then, as the Astros did, go out and add a Brian McCann when no one wanted this guy because of his $18 million salary. You know, being able to add a Verlander at the trade deadline, having the financial flexibility to sign some of their younger players to long-term deals when they hit arbitration. And, you know, Houston's going to be able to do all of that. I think Toronto can too. I don't think they should go into a full rebuild, but I also don't think that they should necessarily throw $200 million on a Band-Aid.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the key now, I think the way you manage your there's not a salary cap, obviously, in baseball, but there's obviously a budget. And I think the key now is that if you can, you take your young and controllable players, and I think you give them a longer-term deal, which is what Shapiro did in Cleveland with a lot of them, and effectively pay a premium to buy out a few of the free agency years, and you'll get them at during their peak earning years. I don't think you want to go too aggressively in the free agent route. I think that's been shown over a long period of time not to work. You know, imagine what could have happened if the Jays had actually acceded to Jose Bautista's salary demands back in 2015. Mm-hmm. I mean, or you know, you look at the Angels with Albert Pujols. I mean, you know, which is an interesting issue as it relates to Josh Donaldson in terms of what you do with him, because I'm not really, I go back and forth on this. I love seeing him in a Blue Jays uniform, but, you know, do you want to pay him another 5 or 6 years? And what's he going to be like at 37, 38 if you do so?
Donaldson, I think it is a really fascinating question. I think people keep kind of falling on either side of the equation. And, you know, I think maybe my heart wants them to go ahead and sign him, and my head sort of sets off warning bells on that. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, you build around a core that you draft and develop, and I think then try and add veterans and sometimes the right veterans who are going to come in there and help prop the team up. And, you know, like a guy like Josh Reddick had a terrible playoffs, a terrible World Series, but, you know, through the run of the season is kind of a reputedly a good clubhouse guy and mm-hmm. a good sort of character guy. And maybe you could get the output that he provides for far less. You know, I mean, I don't know what the difference in production between Josh Reddick and Ezekiel Carrera is. And I'm guessing that it's actually not that huge, but you know, if you've got a team full of young players and you're legitimately a contender, what sort of player do you actually want to slot in there and to help guide the players through to the next level? So I don't know. Where possible, I would like to see the Blue Jays stick to a plan and really kind of covet the core of the team and keep that together, and then, you know, add on veterans that can be even expensive, but who you're not depending on to be the linchpin of your success.
Would you guys give Josh Donaldson 5 years, $150 million? Is that a reasonable offer from a Blue Jays fan's perspective?
That's a reasonable offer. I bet they don't make that offer, but that's a reasonable offer. But bear in mind that, you know, you'll be, you know, maybe it's not going to look so great at 37, 38, especially if you've got Vladdy ready to play. I mean, all those people that were enthusiastic when they signed Russell Martin or when they got Troy Tulowitzki are now saying, God, look at these contracts, and they go to 2019, 2020. That said, I think I probably would sign him, because I think he's one of those unique players, and I think he is one of the, like, as Dal said, he's one of these great character guys that is going to be, you know, the face of your, is a great person to be the face of your franchise going forward, and I think probably would look after himself sufficiently that he probably could be one of those anomalies that would actually be worth paying the money to, and it would send a very positive signal to the fans. So I would do it, but that's what it's going to cost him. I don't think they will. I personally think that they're going to, you know, go the arbitration route, give him his 20 or 25 million, probably, and then they'll keep him for the year or trade him at midseason if it turns out to be a year like this year.
And of course, they did that with Marcus Stroman over $500,000, Jason, which is why I'm having a hard time digesting I mean, I get it. We're talking about the value of foresight and planning, and that would be really nice because many years associated with Gord Ash and J.P. Ricciardi were just throwing years out the window. No plan. You'd show up for one baseball season and you see B.J. Ryan signed. You show up for another and the best pitcher in baseball gets traded. There have been a lot of ups and downs where you just scratch your head and you're left wondering, was there a plan? Anthopoulos, to his credit, we can agree, had a plan. I think it was a five-year plan, and it was one of those plans that didn't work until right at the end when he decided to go all in and gamble. We know that Shapiro is the exact opposite. He doesn't gamble. He's methodical. He's fastidious. He believes in the idea of gradually planting seeds and watching them grow. So why would he give Marcus Stroman an offer knowing that this player is controllable until 2021, which we now know is really the window for when the next generation of Blue Jays will potentially show up and then the old generation will leave? So, Jason, help me understand why this organization or what this organization has done to, in the past to make you believe that they'll make Marcus Stroman a serious offer to stay.
Well, I believe in Mark Shapiro. I can't speak for Ricciardi or Alex Anthopoulos, but... You know, I think that what he's built in Cleveland and his track record of signing young guys to long-term deals and trying to at least buy up the arbitration years, paying them a little bit more now so that you don't have to pay them $20 million in arbitration.
Sure.
With some team options, I think they either need to do that, get serious with extending him, or start shopping him because of the haul that they could get in it. And I know that they've come out and said that they want to be competitive, not so much rebuild, but they're going to compete while still rebuilding. I think you can't do that unless you have Stroman locked down. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you can do that if you let Donaldson walk. I threw out $5,150 with Donaldson. I don't think he would take it. I think he wants that 10-year deal. I'm hoping that teams kind of smarten up after A-Rod and Pujols and think that 10-year deals for guys in their 30s are bad deals. But maybe that's the going market or the going rate now. Maybe they've wised up, and if he doesn't get that offer, then the Blue Jays can get him for, you know, the next 5 years into 37, 38. I don't think he would be that bad of a player at 38, but 41.
He's going to be experiencing a lot of competition that year too, though. I mean, you've got Machado coming out that point,
yeah.
and you've also got, of course, Bryce Harper. So I don't think he'd get more than, I think six would be the maximum he would get. He's a unique player in the sense that he's coming to free agency late in his career. He's a late bloomer. So I don't know if it'll be five at 150 or six, maybe it'll be six at 180 is my guess. It would be the maximum. I can't believe that someone would offer him 10 years, but, you know, underestimate stupidity, I guess.
Although I think that teams now, there aren't a lot of teams that are run, you know, by sort of eccentric millionaires who want to throw money at them, and so, you know, the Pujols contract or a Prince Fielder contract, you know, I'm not sure that those are necessarily going to be out there. Maybe except for Machado and Harper. Because those guys are young, and frankly, if there was a free agent who was 27, yeah, for sure, I think that you try and get the extra years in. You know, understanding that the last couple of years of any free agent deal are going to be less than what you would hope, but you hope that you make up the value in the front end of that deal. So, you know, at 6 years, I think is probably what the minimum is going to be for Josh Donaldson. And then it's just going to be a matter of whether if someone wants to get there. But we've seen the last couple of off seasons how quickly the market drops off and how suddenly players who you would have expected to get some sort of deal are out there. And, you know, what happened with Bautista last year, which was, you know, that he was left out on the market. Edwin Encarnacion ended up taking less than he could have, and probably far less than he thought he was going to get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's
probably
half
of what he thought he was going to get.
Teams are smart, and teams have their own plans and their own sort of succession of players and prospects that they have in mind, and you know. So I'm not. I have maybe some sort of sense that 2018, 2019 free agent class ends up being one where there's going to be winners and losers, and maybe the Blue Jays can benefit from being a team that is able to step in and grab one of the people who can give them some value, even if they sort of get eaten up by the rest of the market.
And of course, gentlemen, there's always the wild card of knowing that there might be a prospect or someone organizationally that steps up and surprises. You know, we've been hearing a lot of names like Ryan Borucki and Danny Jansen and Anthony Alford. Who's to say that if one or two of these players can perform and start embarking on their major league career, it could make 2018 a very intriguing year, to say the least. I'm going to put you on the spot, Marshall, because you are new to the show. Tell our listeners what you've been up to and how they can find you on social media.
Well, it's normally not anything related to baseball stuff. They can get a lot of my things on LinkedIn. I have a lot of stuff that I've written. They can also take the Levy website. But again, nothing to do with sports. They can catch me on YouTube as well, spouting off about markets and stuff. Although talking about the Blue Jays is much more fun than talking about the markets or Donald Trump, for that matter. But thanks for letting me put the plug in.
Hey, my pleasure, especially you being so candid about things. We look forward to your humor. Jason, prospects1500.com. I love it. I read your work all the time. Tell my audience what you've written lately and where they can find you.
So my latest piece was analyzing Bo Bichette's swing. Having seen him a lot, I've heard a lot of people criticize, scouts included, criticize the perceived bat rap. So I wrote an article giving my two cents on it. It's good news for Blue Jays fans. I'm not concerned about it. But in the article, I detail why I'm not concerned about it. And then I am flying out to Arizona next week for the Arizona Fall League. I'll be at 6 games in 3 days. I can't wait to see what Max Pentecost is doing because he's absolutely killing it. And Zoich as well. He also made the All-Star team. Getting to see some of these Atlanta Braves prospects and just guys that I don't get to see in the Florida State League. So I'm excited. So there will be a lot of updates, a lot of video, a lot of write-ups while I'm out there.
My friend, love the fact that you hustle and love your passion for the game. And, of course, last but not least, Mr. Dow of Steve. Always love reading your work on Sportsnet. What have you been writing about lately, and where can my listeners find you?
Find me usually talking about my snack choices on Twitter, at DowSteve. And, it's funny because you mentioned my weekly column at Sportsnet, and I was about to say what I wrote last week, and I honestly forgot exactly what I've written over the last couple of weeks, which I like to think of myself as a bullpen ace or a closer who, you know, steps in and does his thing and then forgets about it for the next day. So something going up on Friday of this week, and I'll still be writing through the off season, maybe even writing a hockey piece or two occasionally. I know how much that's loved to have a Blue Jays writer writing about hockey, and I get the best / worst comments on those pieces. Weirdly enough, I'm actually kind of looking forward to this off season. I think this could be a really interesting and telling one going forward, and I think it's kind of an exciting time for the Blue Jays. I think that there's some great new stuff that's going to be happening soon.
Well, I'm just thrilled to know that you're now a two-sport athlete, and it's always a pleasure, of course, to have you drop by, whether it's for baseball and now hockey. Believe you me, I can relate, having broadcasts in both sports. But, gents, this was really fantastic. I hope you all enjoyed yourself here on the Jays Journal Podcast Roundtable. I look forward to having you back in the future, and we'll continue talking about all the exciting things, hopefully exciting things, that will take place during this season. Thanks again for joining the show.
Thanks, Ari. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ari. All right, thanks, guys.